take a moment to be grateful for the divine mercy that you only have to go through middle school once. And speaking of things best left buried in the past and never to be thought of again, remember the way we all used to just put up with crummy coffee? Thankfully, that's all behind us now that there's Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses premium Arabica beans. They're always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste. But the best part is that Sparkplug custom roasts this exceptional coffee within 1 week of delivering it to you anywhere in the U.S. and Canada so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. There's no commitment, and it's completely flexible, and because you're a top 100 listener, Sparkplug is giving you 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi there, movie enthusiasts, and thanks a whole bunch for plopping the 424th dose of the Top 100 Project right in the middle of your January day. We look back at motion pictures from long ago, and we spoil them so much that we'll never get into a good school. The first 123 of our podcasting efforts was devoted to reviewing the 1998 and 2007 lists of what the AFI considered the greatest classics in American history. We didn't entirely agree with some of those choices. We didn't at all agree with some of those choices. If you want an example of what we sounded like when we weren't very good at this yet, scroll way back and have a look. I'm the clarinetist in that up-and-coming garage band, the Quadratics, Ryan Ellis. And here's the overlooked middle child who has her very own special people club, and wants to know if you want to see her fingers. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Bev is actually the youngest in her family, but truth didn't fit the theme. So that's why I called you Middle Child.
Middle Child was almost the name of this film.
Yeah, that's the working title. And also, of course, as we've said many times, we're both the youngest child in our family. Our parents finally got it right, and they never had sex again.
Exactly.
And they certainly didn't have any more kids, obviously, because
they'd need to.
Unless there's some kind of Simpsons-esque story where they've got a twin of one of us in the cellar, the attic. Then they did stop and there are no more kids. Well, this is getting weird and dark, but that does fit the theme of the movie. So the coming attraction's factoid. Don Wiener is called Wiener Dog, creatively, by the kids at school. You, Bev, the listeners, me, whoever, might not want to relive this. But what's the worst nickname the kids at school ever gave you?
I definitely don't want to relive this. My name is Beverly, and if you just channel your middle school self for about 30 seconds, you'll put together that Beverly sounds a lot like Beaver, which to 12-year-olds is just comedy gold, mm-hmm. and didn't leave me alone for many years. I would be somewhere, like a job or a class or something, and the moment would come where somebody would put it together and go, "Hey, your name's kind of like Beaver," and I knew it was over for me from then on.
I called you Bevers when I first got to know you. Thought maybe that might be your nickname, and you did not like it, so I didn't continue.
Oh, did I really? I don't remember that at all.
I didn't mean it that way. It's Bevers.
Bevers. Well, Bevers. Beavers.
It's high school was Jeff, and the basketball coach called him Jeffers. So that's where I got that from.
Oh, it's kind of cute. I don't know why I gave you a hard time. It's not that close. Plus, we're adults now, so I feel like people can leave it alone. I had boobs before everyone in my class, so I got nicknames about that, too. I remember it was the early 90s back then, and I got called Twin Peaks because that show was popular. And, yeah, laugh
it up. A show you like, though, so at least it's a bit of a compliment.
Oh, at least it's a show I like. Actually, it bugged me, but that was good-natured teasing for my friends.
It is funny how kids will tease girls about getting boobs and give them a hard time when most boys, and certainly most men, like boobs an awful lot through their entire life. So why are you mocking somebody for getting something that you want them to have anyway?
Well, isn't that just the theme of this movie? Kids that age are both massively fascinated and terrified by sex and their sudden new feelings about things like boobs, and then they're mean to girls for having boobs even though they like boobs. So what's yours? What's your nickname before we get too deep into this? Because I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about that kind of stuff.
I couldn't think of anything all that good. My sister and I were called Elvis, which is somewhat creative, I guess. Again,
that's
awesome.
Not that insulting,
a bit of a compliment.
Yeah.
I don't remember having very many nicknames in my life. Kind of wish I had one sometimes, I guess. Some of my teammates called me Caretaker for a while based on Chris Rock's character in The Longest Yard. That was the mid-2000s, I guess, and our team had just started. I wasn't bothered by it, but I thought, am I really the caretaker of this team? But anyway, that one guy always called me that.
what was distinctive feature of the caretaker?
Chris Rock is effectively the manager of the football team, I think. And that's also the name of the character. Because Chris and I covered the original Longest Yard and Scoring at the Movies long ago. And there's a character called Caretaker.
So it's
caretaker.
Not like he's stupid or evil or something.
It's not an insult. No, that's what I'm saying. I don't really have any good examples. If there's something I'm not thinking of.
La-dee-da. Look who never got picked on in middle school.
Go talk to a therapist. They might unlock something. I'm saying, oh no, there were two or three that haunt me to this day. So before we go any further, we'll announce that we have another foster dog. Let's hope this one lives.
Oh my God. For anyone who's out of the loop, we had a foster dog that tragically died during a routine operation.
Yeah, earlier in the year. I guess now last year. We're still recording this in 2021. But we had Teddy, and he liked to sit with us and literally lay on our chests. He was so light, you could lay him on your chest. We didn't even really feel him there. But yeah, sometimes he had to cuddle with us during the podcast.
Exactly. Like, he can only go so long without being on someone's lap. And he would get impatient while we were doing the podcast. And he would crawl up on Ryan. And you would just basically cuddle him for the last 20 or 30 minutes of the recording.
But Jewel down there, who was licking herself enthusiastically, is now settled. And, of course, Sam's with us as always. But Tilly just does not join us anymore since we moved to this house.
Yeah, she's a little old lady. She doesn't like to climb the stairs.
Okay, let's go. Middle Child in Middle School was screened at a few festivals, including the Toronto International Film Festival. That was in 1995, and that's why if you look on the IMDb, it says 1995 for the release date. But this was released to the general public by Sony Pictures Classics on May 24th, 1996. It had a pretty small budget, so its box office take made it quite a little indie hit. And this is, of course, one of Bev's choices in the month of Bev. But the movie is, let's see, math again, 36 years old. Did I get that right? 26 years old. Fascinating part of the podcast. Please give us a skinny Bev on this 26-year-old movie called Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Heather Matarazzo is Dawn Wiener, a hopelessly unpopular 7th grader in suburban New Jersey. Dawn is tormented by bullies, ignored by her family, and can't quite figure out how to fit in and get it right. When one of Dawn's worst bullies begins a clumsy and bizarre courtship, she's torn between him and Steve, the older heartthrob who sings in her brother's terrible garage band.
Steve Rogers, incidentally. Must be a play on Captain America. Yeah. Long before the MCU, of course, but from the comics. And there was a Captain America movie in the early 90s that we didn't say his name yet. The director, writer, and producer, Todd Solondz, may have been homaging that. And he is the heartthrob of the whole movie. He is not a hero, but I can see why there's that.
He's got a bad boy thing, and he doesn't care. He's very cool. Mm-hmm. And he's quite a bit older than Dawn, and she still is such a child. So much so that he doesn't even notice that she has this giant crush on him, even though she's tragically obvious about it.
He treats her better than a lot of people.
It's true.
He actually stands up for her at one point, too, against her brother Mark. Or, in a nutshell, hurt people hurt people.
That could sum it up pretty
fits
nicely.
This movie, because she bullies little kids. Early on, she stands up for that kid, Troy, when he's being bullied, but he doesn't want her sympathy, so he runs off and he hates her for bothering to help him out. And then as the movie goes along, she's bullying kids smaller than her. Not all people get bullied. I would say generally they probably don't react like that, but she does, so God knows where this is going to go. And also, the original nutshell I had is something along these lines. I don't like the wording, so that's why I changed it to that very well-known phrase now, hurt people, hurt people. But how can you be happy when the people who treat you the worst are your own family? The kids at school are bad, but her parents aren't good to her, especially her mother. Her little sister is a tyrant and a sociopath, maybe, and always seems to get what she wants. And even this little thing I just noticed in looking at the IMDb before we started recording, you got Mark and Missy. Mark's the oldest, Missy's the youngest, and Dawn's in the middle. So the naming convention isn't even consistent. Not that it has to be, but M and M, first and last, but D in the middle.
Although Mark is way closer to Dawn in his status in the family than he is to Missy. Missy is their favorite. It's very, very obvious.
The parents' favorite.
And they're not abusive, we should say. They're not terribly mean to her, but they just don't love her.
Just bad enough, yeah.
There's a huge apathy there and this real impatience for her, but it really just boils down to the fact that her parents don't love her. I don't think they love Mark either. There's a funny scene where
they got it right with the last kid.
See,
like
the
us.
Last kid's always the best one. They have to pretend to love our older siblings. Get it.
Two dry runs that failed.
But you and I are the Missies of our family.
Yeah, that's why we're saying this.
There's a funny scene where Missy is missing Missy. Her parents are just so distraught, and her father won't get out of bed. It's like he's dying. He's so sad about it. And she says to him, at least you still have me and Mark. And he starts moaning. like Jacob Marley in bed. Oh. And she doesn't know what to do, so she awkwardly leaves. But he's just so horrified by the idea of being stuck with his two older children.
Her best acting moment in the whole film is probably when we find out that Missy's missing. I think the camera is panning, I believe, yes, from left to right. And you see everyone on the couch, and I believe the cops are there. What are we going to do? Where is she? Where are we going to find her? And then the horrified look on Dawn's face. But she wanted it to happen at the same time, too. Maybe that's why she's horrified. She feels like, I made my... Oh, like in Home Alone, I made my sister disappear.
Yes. Well, there's a scene prior to that when she destroys the videotape with the hammer. And when she's coming back inside, it's the middle of the night. And her sister is sleeping peacefully in her bed. And she just stands over her
for
with
a
hammer in her hand. And you know she's just thinking about it. And she's like, I better not. But I don't know if she wanted Missy to get kidnapped. But she knew what she was doing. It's not like she just forgot to tell Missy that she needed to get a ride home with someone else. She knew she would be abandoned sitting alone outside her dance class.
But what were the odds she'd get abducted, though?
Right.
You can understand Dawn's point of view. Okay, we're deep into the podcast. This has been happening a lot the last few months, where I ask you what you think of the movie probably 10, 15 minutes in. But you chose it. Obviously, you love it. We haven't watched it in a while, so some details are probably going to be lost on me, especially. I've seen this, I think, twice, maybe three times ever. Anyway, your initial thoughts on
yeah, sure.
Welcome to The Dollhouse.
I love this movie so much. It really hits that dark comedy sweet spot for me.
Does it also hit home? You were bullied?
I was bullied in middle school. I was no Don Wiener.
But you weren't the bombshell you are now. No, really, you were gawky. I've seen pictures, right? You've admitted that.
Thanks, babe. I was. No, I was gawky. I mean, everybody goes through a gawky stage. This is what hits home, and this is the honesty of this film that I feel is what makes it stand out even now. I don't know if there's another movie that comes close. Maybe Eighth Grade.
Bo Burnham must have been influenced by this movie when he made that
one. Oh, absolutely. Even though Eighth Grade is Pollyanna compared to this movie, and Eighth Grade is not a walk in the park as far as coming-of-age films go.
She's not really being bullied in that anyway. She's just being ignored. Which you said Dawn is,
yeah,
too. But Dawn is also being called Wiener Dog by an entire assembly of kids.
Yeah.
And Kayla in Eighth Grade is not dealing with that.
The bullying is extreme. There's that scene in the bathroom where Cookie makes her take a shit in front of her. That's not really realistic. But what is realistic to me about it is that the bullies are nuanced. But more so that Dawn isn't some perfect victim. Like you said, she's mean to her little sister. She's mean to her friend who's nice to her, her neighbor Ralphie.
Right.
And she takes her pain out on other people. And she's also really self-absorbed.
That's what Solange does so smartly here, and why this movie has probably lasted after all this time, and why it was respected at the time, I think.
Yeah, part
is because she's not just a victim. Not even close.
Part of the reason that she is so bad at fitting in is because she just seems to have this total lack of awareness of the world around her. That's why she can't figure it out. She wears the wrong clothes. She says the wrong things. I think if this movie came out now, people would definitely speculate, is she supposed to be on the spectrum? Because
oh, yeah,
she's just so removed from all the kids around her and how to interact with them. A way that I relate is, yeah, I was picked on, or even in the sense that I was very much the victim of mean girl bullying.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as this, right? You were never this.
I was never that bad. But I remember there were kids in my school that were the Don Wiener of our school. And
you tortured them, didn't you?
No, but I did bully people. And it's funny because I'm haunted by the bullying I experienced, but I am really haunted by
the bullying
I took part in and even initiated.
We talked about it in Mean Girls, where your
yes,
best friend for a long time was the classic mean girl. Not a high school student. You knew her when you were a little older. I guess you knew her
when
you were
young. No, we met in grade 9.
I'm just talking about when I knew you, though, that I could still see it in her.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's no different now. It's probably even worse now.
She's a bit of a Regina George. Even before I met her, though, when I was in middle school, and it wasn't like I was picking on them because I was so hurt. I would never draw that through line. I would say I picked on them because I didn't like them. They took the focus off of me. You know, like when you make somebody a pariah, then they become the lightning rod and you're safe from
sure,
everybody else's bullying. So there's the power of feeling like you can belittle someone and make them feel small. And then there is the way that making them a scapegoat and the lightning rod, like I said, keeps you protected.
Defense mechanism.
And it probably keeps people scared of you because I have a pretty quick wit. So the more I developed that, the more I could kind of use that to pick on people.
Quick wit, eh?
Well, I don't have a comeback. This is the worst.
That was a quick wit.
I should never brag about having a quick wit and not have a comeback for that.
Well, I just recently said to you in a little poem I wrote for you at Christmas that making you laugh is my favorite thing to do. And you're certainly one of the funniest people I've ever met.
Thank you, baby. That was my Christmas present. Not the poem, just him telling me I'm one of the funniest people he's ever met. Right now, that's my Christmas present.
Saying it again. Twice in about a week. Not even a week, it's only been a few days.
Looking back on the cruelty of children, both the cruelty I experienced and the cruelty I doled out, it's funny how you don't see it in movies very often, and I wonder if it's because none of us can tolerate living in that headspace again.
We've had a few movies over the years for sure we've covered, and we haven't done Eighth Grade, but that would fit the theme too. I love that movie so very much.
Yeah, I need to see it again. It's been a little while.
I think I've seen it at least three times, maybe even four. But Mean Girls certainly fits that theme. That was just last year. And I feel like we did at least one other one last year that was a bullying type of film. And I know we've done more than that. We've talked about a lot of movies, even if we haven't actually covered them, like the movie that was called The Bully Project at the film festival here, the Hot Docs Film Festival. We saw that, and that just became Bully. That was a powerful film. But anyway, I think it does get covered more often than you might think.
Here's my counter to that. It gets covered, but I feel like Hollywood has this really two-dimensional version of what a bully is and what a victim is.
I just thought of something right now, by the way. I said Steve Rogers earlier.
Mm.
The pre-PED Steve Rogers
is a pipsqueak.
Gets bullied. Not by Bucky. Bucky was always his friend. But the other guys treat him like this nobody, this nothing. Not as bad as Don gets treated, but in some ways he's bullied too. And then we have Steve Rogers in this movie.
He's not a bully. No.
So that's
he's Solange's, not a bully and he doesn't get bullied.
Solange is smart. He could have called Steve Rogers a bully in this movie, I guess, or something like that. But I don't
and
know.
In a lesser Maybe it's not movie, intentional. Steve would have been a prick because he's handsome, because all the girls want him. But actually, every time we see him, he's doing right by Dawn. He's being nice to her. He argues with Mark, but Mark is kind of a pill as well. You can understand why they would have friction. But I think one of the most interesting characters and the thing that makes this movie stand out so much is Brandon, who is a total mustache-twisting, mouth-breathing bully at the beginning of the film. Her worst tormentor physically pushes her around
and stuff.
So
she's going to rape her.
I feel so uncomfortable every time this scene happens, but it also feels pretty believable in the sense that they're play-acting.
Do you think he knows what that word means?
No, that's just it. And she knows he doesn't know what it means. The same way she doesn't know what finger-fucking is.
There's the R rating.
But come on, it's so funny. But she shows Steve her fingers like he might want to fuck.
Well, the way she shows him, too. Well, it's not even as elegant as what you just did there. She holds her hands like she's
like they're
paralyzed or something like that.
She's just waiting for him to react.
Because he had finger fucked a girl is why. Yeah.
The scene is so funny, but it also is illustrative of the way that 11-year-olds don't know. But they're growing up and there's so much curiosity and fear associated with all these things. So when Brandon says, I'm going to rape you, they're just pretending. It's like they're still playing pretend. And then, of course, there's the cliche of, he must like you because he's tugging on your pigtails. Oh, another thing, when I was in seventh grade, there was a boy in my class named Danny. He was my tormentor. He was capable of cruelty that was next level. And he had this way of knowing what to say that absolutely preyed on my worst insecurities. He would call me fat, and he was in my class. And if he was in the room, my heart rate was up. He made me so nervous. And then years later, I befriended his older brother. Yeah, you were in Danny's class. He was obsessed with you. He was in love with you. He had this terrible crush on you. Same with this other kid, Adam, from sixth grade, who was the only person I ever have gotten in
we
a
are seeing
physical
why
fight
I've
with.
Wanted to cover Welcome to the Dollhouse right
Maybe
now.
Maybe this is it. These boys that were so cruel to me. But Adam actually physically fought me once. It scared the shit out of me,
Did
as you
win?
Can imagine. What do you think? We just tumbled around in the snow. It was not a big deal. He scared me. And then all of seventh grade, also, I would catch him looking at me and stuff. Everybody knew. The whole school knew he had this big crush on me. But I was scared of him, so it was kind of a non-starter. My parents loved me, so I didn't have Dawn Wiener's neediness. Part of the reason she puts up with Brandon, I'm sure, is because she truly does not understand what love looks like. So
he's also paying attention to her, and her family's
exactly.
not. That's why I say they may be more subtle about it, or not even subtle, but they're not as brutally, obviously, we're treating you badly the way the kids do. But that's one thing at school for a matter of hours. I'm sure it's not every minute of the day, but she goes home, and she's never accepted, never liked. Missy wins every argument. Missy's always going to be right. Missy picks a fight and lies about what happened, and Dawn gets punished. So that's why I said earlier that her home life is probably worse, even though it isn't things like a kid saying, I'm going to rape you. But then they kiss so often that clearly Brandon, played by Brendan, so Brendan Sexton plays Brandon McCarthy, Brendan Sexton Jr., according to the credits here, nobody else seems to want to be around her, but he chooses to be around her multiple times. And yeah, what he says is terrible, but when you realize that he doesn't really know what he's saying, that gives us a very complex, again, in this movie, complex relationship.
And I'm so curious with him why he likes Dawn. She's such a social pariah that even the boy that she rescues from the police is like, fuck off, wiener dog, because he can't be seen with her. He can't stand to lose one more rung.
An easy answer for this.
Yeah.
Somebody's attracted to somebody. There's always somebody out there that would find you attractive. Maybe you've never met them. Maybe they live in Mongolia and you live in Colorado, but they'd be your heartthrob. And yet, to the average person, they'd say, who is that? Think of the worst thing you can say about somebody with their looks. But somebody might be attracted to you somewhere. Yeah. That's part of that. And also, in the opening credits, when they show the family photo as the credits are playing out, I said to you, she's actually kind of cute there. She's got a great big smile on her face.
Yeah.
The polar opposite to the last shot of the movie when she's on the bus singing with every other kid.
Morosely looking out the window.
She looks like she's heading to what you said, one of the movies that picks up on this, one of the other Salons movies, that she would like to die. Didn't you say it starts out with Dawn Wiener having killed herself?
Yeah, so she reappears in two more of his films, in Palindromes and then later in Wiener Dog. I have not seen Wiener Dog because I can't stand seeing dogs in peril.
There's an actual Wiener Dog, though.
There's an actual Wiener Dog. The whole movie is about, it's too stressful for me to watch a movie where a dog could get hurt, even their feelings hurt. I know it's pathetic. I read the description on Wikipedia because I was so curious about this. So in Palindromes, which came out, I don't know, in the early 2000s, that film opens with Dawn's funeral, and her brother Mark is doing a eulogy for her that actually is heartbreaking and really sweet. And it made me go back and watch this movie differently, especially her relationship with Mark. They pick on each other, like brothers and sisters do, but I actually feel like they get each other, and I can totally see their relationship once they're adults and they can see each other eye to eye instead of like bratty siblings. There would be love there, or at the very least, a real camaraderie against the rest of their family. They're alike. They feel like family.
In the family, they're the most alike.
And so he's the one that does her eulogy, and it's heartbreaking. She died by suicide in Palindromes. And then the movie is about her cousin. It's an interesting film. I don't know if I would hugely recommend it. Then years later, she comes back in Wiener Dog, where she's alive again. She kills herself in college, but in Wiener Dog, she's like 35. I mean, this is very Salons, too. He doesn't really care about canon in his own film. So he decided to bring her back, and there's a whole section of that film, because it's very episodic, where she's there, she reunites with Brandon, and they meet Brandon's brother, who's grown up and has married another person with Down syndrome.
Okay.
So Dawn has a very heartbreaking ending in Palindrome, and then a much more optimistic, happy ending in 2016.
Palindromes.
Thank you. Captain Pedant.
And a lot of, well, actually, he's in the last couple of months.
Actually.
A key thing, and a very key line in this film, is I think the last exchange Mark and Dawn have, where he ends up being her anti-Dan Savage, where he says to her effectively, not the exact words, but things don't get better. Because she wonders what the rest of middle school is like. They'll be better when you get to high school, or maybe at least, maybe not for her, but he had some of the same experiences, I guess, because he says, it's not going to be better next year.
High school gets better because they'll still make fun of you, but they'll say it behind your back. He's so resigned to it. You can see how he as a character has his own coping mechanisms. He's just really focused on getting into a good college. I think he just feels like once he escapes New Jersey and this little small world that he lives in where he clearly doesn't fit in, once he can get out on his own, he can find his tribe and he can begin to live. And he's so hyper-focused on that.
Get into a good school.
This will look good in your college application. It's funny, but it feels, again, super honest. I've knew kids like that, too. Hyper-focused on their college applications.
Yeah. All right, well, let's track back to something I usually would have done 10 minutes ago, at least, and talk about the Rotten Tomatoes numbers and whatnot. So, those numbers are good. 90% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes were fans of the film. The average was 7.8 out of 10 on the strength of 51 reviews, and 86% of audiences. Roger Ebert ranked it number 5 on his top 10 list in 1996, and Gene Siskel had it 8th. It was also 154th at the 1996 U.S. box office. We've covered these three films, and what a foursome this would make if you want to watch these all in one day. So different, but Independence Day, we covered that last year, was number 1. Scream, we covered that last year, and Scary Movie Month was number 13. And Fargo, which made the original top 100 project list, well, the AFI list, was 67th, and that's the best film of all of those. But what a diversity. And Welcome to the Dollhouse also won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. This isn't Salonza's first film, so it wasn't like it was his coming out party. He made a movie in 1989, though, a long time in between films. Yeah. He hasn't made that many in his long career. And he is now, I think, 62 years old. I think people thought of him as this young prodigy type, maybe Soderbergh. They look somewhat similar, or looked, in the beginning of their careers, somewhat similar. Soderbergh has a
bit... And they're 90s indie
darlings. Soderbergh, what am I doing? I sound like these people that say his name wrong. Soderbergh. I hate when people say Soderbergh. Idiot. Well, actually, Ryan, it is Soderbergh.
I love it. You well actually yourself.
Yep. Anyway, so they look somewhat similar, and Soderbergh was pretty young, but Salonza, when he started, especially this movie, not his very first one, was not really that young. He was already, I think, in his mid-30s. But he somehow found a way, and maybe always did, but certainly in this movie and parts of the other ones, I've seen them all, but I can't remember that much about them, except for one we'll get to in a second. He finds a way to connect and relate and know about kids better than most directors ever have. A lot of really talented people have had good movies about kids, but this guy gets them more than most people do.
And he has kid characters that, to me, are sometimes super realistic, sometimes less so, almost high fantasy versions of a child. But they're so interesting. He has such an interesting take on children. He doesn't treat them like they're precious. He said in an interview that he was really tired of seeing kids always either like omen evil monsters or they were over-the-top cute dolls. He's like, it's just not interesting and everything looks the same. And somebody had recommended The Wonder Years to him. You'll love this show. It's the exact time period you grew up. It'll reflect your own childhood and it'll be so nice. And he watched it and he was like, this is nothing like my childhood. He hated how saccharine and sanitized everything was. He then wrote the screenplay for Welcome to the Dollhouse and just put it in a drawer because he thought, no one's ever going to make this film. It's so dark. It was much darker. Even the original drafts of his script included an actual rape, and it was much, much darker than what it ended up being. He said the process of rewrites was basically the process of lightening it up as he went along. Now, he didn't fight that dark instinct in some of his later films because he's made some pretty dark films about some insane subject matter.
The very next movie he made, I've only ever seen it once, and yet it has really stuck with me. And we thought about doing it a few years ago. You almost chose it. I think we thought it wouldn't get any kind of downloads. Maybe this won't either. Although this, I think, is pretty well known, especially in indie circles. But Happiness.
I feel like Happiness is right up there with Welcome to the Dollhouse. Those are like the two flagship Todd
Solondz
movies.
That's adults mostly, though. We have kids in the Dylan Baker scenes, but isn't it generally adults in that film?
Yeah. And then Palindromes, the main character, is a little kid, played variously by different actors, including some adults.
Mm.
And there's a very interesting little boy in Storytelling where he hypnotizes his parents. Do you remember this? John Goodman is his dad.
You say Storytelling, the first thing I picture, the only thing I picture is, what's her name again? She was in Legally Blonde. Selma Blair getting anally, not raped, but anally fucked
by
Keith
sex.
David, maybe?
Yeah. Todd Solondz was, I guess, a bit of a brat, and they really wanted him to take that scene out. And he thought that they were only censoring it because the man was black and she was white. And so as an act of protest, instead of just taking the scene out, he left it in but put a big red box over top of them for the American version. European version, it just has the scene. I think I've seen both versions. I can't remember now. He's a bit of a brat. With every film, I don't know what you think, but I really like Todd Solondz's sensibility, but I think he just gets a little bit worse with every movie.
Well, Happiness stayed with me despite only having seen it once. And this generally did, too. It wasn't like I watched this and thought, oh, yeah, these are 12 things I don't remember. It's more like two things, three things I didn't remember. But as far as storytelling goes, apart from that scene I just mentioned, nope. Palindromes, nope. Wiener Dog, nope. It's just escaped my brain entirely. I'm not saying they aren't good movies or that they're not worth seeing, but I see so many films and not all of them stay in my brain.
He has a very unique sensibility. That's one of the things I like best about him. Well, of course, the darkness of him, the cynicism, that black comedy, pitch black.
Well, here's
comedy.
A black comedy
really like
thing
that.
As well, along with her great look when she realizes her sister got kidnapped. But she has to write a dignity speech as part of a detention. And in the very next scene, after she can barely get through it because, what is it, the kids or a teacher aren't really letting her get through it, the next scene, she's bullied and they take away her dignity.
Well, they take away her dignity by forcing her to read this terrible dignity essay, being berated by the teacher. Dignity is very important and grade grubbing is bad. And she's clearly being humiliated on purpose. It's so undignified to do that to her.
But then the very next scene, they make it even more explicit by, yet again, treating her terribly.
Yeah.
Well, at one point, the Quadratics do play the song Welcome to the Dollhouse. And I asked you if it's a cover song. Did it exist before this movie? And you don't seem to recognize it either.
No.
What do you think it exactly means?
I don't know. I love this movie, and I've never understood why they called it Welcome to the Dollhouse, especially when Middle Child would have been an amazing title for it.
Yeah, like Lisa Simpson said at one point, overlooked middle child, and starts to cry. I forget why, because she was always overlooked. So we talked about the Brandon and Dawn relationship, and it's a strange one. When he does threaten rape the first time, I like how it's at 3 o'clock. It's nice to know that rapists obey school rules.
He's not going to cut class.
We have a plan.
To rape Dawn.
I don't get punished. We'll do it later. And then, of course, he does bail at the end. He runs away. He kisses her multiple times, though. And, of course, never does actually push it any further that we see than that. And, in fact, he's the one that gets hurt by her when she says she's in love with Steve. And she must like Brandon, but not enough to choose the one that's actually spending time with her, despite the weird relationship. We already said that Steve sticks up for her, and he's really not a bad guy by the looks of it. But it is a weird love triangle that never goes further than kissing, and that is enough. She's not even 12 years old.
You know, when you're that age, you still are capable of that imagination and that magical thinking. But you're starting to get a more grown-up brain about romance and sex. So didn't you have just incredibly out there crushes?
I had a lot of crushes on girls. I think we've talked about this in other podcasts before as well. I dated very rarely in high school. I wish I dated a ton. I wish I had way more courage, really, up until I was in my adulthood, actually, in college as well. Although I had a girlfriend through most of college, so I wasn't going to date anybody else anyway. But definitely had a lot of crushes, and I never responded the way that Brandon does in this, or played it too cool for school like Steve does. Although Steve just doesn't seem like he realizes that this kid is into him in the first place. And even if he realizes it, what's he supposed to do about it? Whether he's attracted to her or not, hopefully he realizes she's too young for me to be dating, or a lot more than that, or to be letting her show her fingers to him. He doesn't realize when she does it, why she does it. But anyway, I wanted to be the guy who was with all the girls, dating at least some of them, but I was terrified of rejection.
I was boy crazy. Like you, I was obsessed with it, and I was terrified of it at the same time, and I used to think about it day and night and never do anything about it. And I had crushes on boys that were way older than me. You know, I had older sisters, and they hung around the house, and I had crushes on all of their friends. Oh my God. Hopeless crushes on all these cool older boys that hung out, and I would try to flirt with them, and they were all really nice to me, but never crossed the line. It never got weird or anything. And of course, now as an adult, I'm like, thank God those kids were cool and none of them took advantage of me, because man alive, I was in love with them.
So the thing as well with the Missy subplot towards the end, which doesn't entirely fit in this movie, even though it is funny, and I didn't dislike it because he makes it work. It's a tonal thing that he basically makes work. But she's found with a pedophile neighbor. And obviously Solange has a pedophile thing going on, because that is the most memorable part of Happiness, which has a lot of memorable parts. I think it's the very first scene where John Lovitz proposes, is it to Jane Addams?
Yeah.
She says, what, I want to think about her or something, or maybe she says no, and he reacts with such vitriol. You were in love with her minutes ago, seconds ago, and now you hate her guts. That is something I'd never seen in a movie before, but also the stuff that Dylan Baker does. And in this movie, in a way, maybe it's a prequel to what was coming with that. Although nothing seems to have happened to Missy.
Also, palindromes.
Okay.
Has pedophilia in it.
And it's fitting that it is somebody that she would have known, because that generally is what happens. Abductions, abuse, probably pedophilia, that kind of thing happens with people you know. It isn't so often, as we've talked about this before in other rape-type issue movies, the Melfi rape. Melfi in The Sopranos was raped by some random guy who just wanted to do it to her. Maybe he knew her. I forget if there's any kind of details, but it wasn't like somebody she knew.
He was a stranger.
It wasn't Tony that did it, which would have been the more common way that women, or I guess even men, get assaulted and raped by people they know.
In the case of Missy, in another great dark comedy touch, she is untouched. All he wanted her to do was dance. He had never actually crossed the line with her, as far as I know, which I think in cinema language we're supposed to take at face value, that he didn't actually hurt Missy. He just kidnapped her and watched her dance and got off that way. And she was blissfully unaware of everything that was going on around her and that she was in danger. So she is unharmed, but she is a star again. Everybody already loved her before, and now everybody loves her even more. She's this great story of the kid that was saved, and Dawn and Mark are pushed further into the background.
Since when were you abducted by anybody? What have you done for me lately in the abduction front?
The funniest is when Dawn goes to New York City to look for Missy.
And has a fantasy where everybody loves her.
Yeah, Yes.
Or at least likes her.
It's heartbreaking. Her dream. And again, that childish fantasy that she wants love so bad. She wants that attention that Missy just seems to get by some kind of birthright. When she calls home the following morning after she has spent an entire night away, Mark answers the phone and she's like, does Mom think I'm kidnapped? He's like, no, nobody cares. Missy came home. Get home. She's going to kill you. Nobody cares if she's missing. It's so sad.
This movie is a horror film at times, too. Well, Heather Mandarazza was making her debut. I'm going to say this word a lot in the next little while here. Debut. She was in quite a few films, though, in her career, or has been in her career. Scream 2, she's in that the year after this, I believe that came out. She was in both Princess Diaries picks. We saw the first one last year. And she actually is a lesbian. I don't think she really realized that at the time because she was a young kid herself. So the bullying would have hit close to home, especially in retrospect.
Well, she said that she kept getting called a lesbo in this movie. Mm-hmm. And she didn't know what it meant, and so she looked it up. That's how she learned what a lesbian was. And as soon as she knew that they existed, she realized that she was a lesbian. Mm. I read the interview where she talks about this, and it seemed like it was a cheerful discovery on her part. Hey, that's me! Like, she felt seen when she discovered that this was a thing. But she has had plenty of pretty bleak things to say about her experience starring in this movie. Of course, it hurt her feelings to have a movie where people are constantly calling her ugly. Interviews where everybody's focusing on what was it like to be the ugly girl and her internalizing that. She's not ugly. She's definitely not Hollywood pretty.
Picture.
She's very cute.
She's actually, when she smiles, I know men get accused of saying this to women and it's a bad thing, but when she's smiling in that picture they show in the opening credits, she's got a bit of an ugly cute thing. She's the Sam of their family.
Sam's our dog who has an underbite and has no eyes.
And he's not attractive, but he's cute to us.
Yeah, she has
also
a lovability.
And when he smiles, he's cuter.
Not like it should matter, especially when you're evaluating an 11-year-old. It shouldn't even be on your mind.
Speaking of cute, Jewel, the foster dog, has splayed out on her back and displaying herself for us.
She's got one arm right up in the air.
And she's very cute.
She has a hell of an underbite. She is pretty weird. She looks like a Wookiee. She's really cute. Anyway, so is Heather Mandarazza. She's so cute in this movie, and you know that they just call her ugly.
Oh, I wouldn't say generally. I'm talking the opening shot.
I'm just saying she's not ugly. They call her ugly, but that's what you call someone when you're trying to make them miserable. And it's really her social awkwardness that is making her the target of bullies, not the way she looks.
Well, by Hollywood standards.
But she did, like, have a hard time.
By Hollywood standards, this is, and I think this is probably generally true in Stallone's films, not an attractive cast, by Hollywood standards.
No, and he's been fairly consistent about that. I mean, he's cast some pretty good-looking people. He also cast a kid with real Down syndrome in this film. I can't remember if the actor has cerebral palsy or if it's just the character in storytelling. And there's a whole chunk of palindromes that takes place in a home for children with disabilities. It more accurately reflects the real world. Not everybody is beautiful, and there's lots of people who are different in one big way or another.
He's giving people a shot.
It's giving people a shot. It's also just a more accurate reflection of the world, which I think Welcome to the Dollhouse is. And it's funny because his style changes pretty significantly to the point where it's very unrealistic. Palindromes is a pretty experimental film. But even when you get into his later films like Life During Wartime, it seems like it's almost Brechtian. It's trying to be very unreal. The acting is intentionally bad. The script is weird. The sets, everything just seems very forced and phony, but it's an intentional artifice. I'm not saying it's good. He started off making films that used edginess to plumb the depths of human experience, and then it was like he just started making films that were edgy because that was his brand. It started feeling really phony. I stopped connecting with them. This movie, I feel the most emotional connection of any of his films. I love Happiness a lot, but it's not a movie that I emotionally connect to.
One of the reasons we didn't cover it a couple of years ago, I think we were going to do it in 2018, is that it wasn't available at the library, and I'm not sure it was available in any other place.
I owned it on DVD once upon a time, but who knows?
I think I'm right about that I couldn't find it for us to watch anyway, regardless of wanting to cover it or not wanting to cover it. Okay, so Brendan Sexton, who does play Brandon, was in Boys Don't Cry a couple of years after this, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. He's got some decent credits beyond those, too. Speaking of acting, Todd Solondz, the very next year after this, had a very tiny cameo, no dialogue, in a movie polar opposite of anything he's ever made, As Good As It Gets.
Really?
He's on the bus. Eric Mabius, who does play Steve Rogers, was in Cruel Intentions and Resident Evil. Darina Kalanina, who does play Missy, the cute one of the family, the only movie she ever made. guess didn't like acting all that much. Matthew Faber, the older brother, was in Palindromes. Is that the one with the funeral you talked about?
Yeah. He's okay. the one doing the eulogy.
Still playing Mark. I was going to ask you that earlier and didn't. Okay.
Yeah, so there's continuity there. He recasts Don Wiener. Greta Gerwig plays Don Wiener in Wiener Dog.
Okay. Christina Brocato, in her debut, was in no other movies until 2008, but was in The Intern with De Niro and Hathaway a couple of years ago, but has mostly done TV. We saw Christina Vidal in Freaky Friday and has done a lot of TV. And this is a big one, I think, actually. At the time, of course, he wasn't. And he doesn't look anything like he usually does. But Ken Leung from Lost, and he had a tiny role in AI, which we covered last summer, is in the movie, too. He's in the band. He's the keyboardist, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Or the drummer? Keyboardist.
Yes, yeah. Keyboardist, yeah.
We already mentioned Salon's credits. I think we've gone over all of that. And the word we haven't used until right now, cringe cinema.
Yes.
A lot of directors have done this, but maybe nobody's done it better than when he's at his best. Making you watch something you don't want to watch, especially some of the stuff in Happiness with Dylan Baker and those two boys, his own son and the one who plays the son's friend, and the pedophilia going on there.
The pedophilia.
I still remember it so well, but only saw it one time. That says a lot. Irreversible, I've talked about that movie a few times, only ever saw that once, still in my brain. Happiness is another one.
I feel like everybody needs to see Happiness for the scene in the beginning with John Lovitz and Jane Addams and the whole storyline with the pedophile. It's
also
such an interesting take.
Philip Seymour Hoffman calling...
Laura Flynn Boyle.
Right, and then whacking off.
Yeah. I was in film school when that movie came out and everybody saw it and everybody could not shut up about that part of the movie especially. It probably doesn't seem as radical now that we have the internet and everything, but when Happiness came out, it was incredibly daring.
With fairly well-known actors. Baker and Hoffman, even Laura Flynn Boyle, I don't think were really stars at that point, no. But they're well enough known. Lovett certainly was well enough known at that
point.
And
it was so against type for Lovett. He was this funny Lovett. SNL guy.
You keep singularizing things.
Because I listen to John Lovett all the time. It's because I'm a fan of Love It or Leave It.
Don't forget that is that at the end. Okay, the movie's 185-1. We saw the Crapalicious DVD, but you own it, so we just watched it that way.
It was an atrocious print.
Yeah. The cinematographer, Randy Drummond, in his debut, also shot Series 7, The Contenders.
I love that movie. Another random indie film from the 90s.
The early 2000s, I think it is.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You brought that into the marriage. I've seen that a few times.
I brought that into the marriage. It's your step film.
Right. The editor, Alan Oxman, in his debut, cut Happiness and Storytelling and other films. And the composer, the only movie credit ever for Jill Wisoff, I don't know how you say the name, Wisoff. And of course, there's also a lot of classical music in this film. We said the print's terrible, but what'd you think of the look? The short film, not even an hour and a half, so the cutting, and of course, the music by someone who never did that again, at least not for films.
Well, in the music, there's not a ton of it anyway, but like you said, there's a lot of classical, and there's that guitar sting thing that happens between scenes. Almost
and
like
then, of course, the band is playing.
And the band,
times.
Yeah. Cinematography, I mean, it's a comedy, it's passable. I always have to shout out the production design. Oh my god, the production design in this movie. That house, the Wiener house, is this specific kind of 90s ugly house with carpet that looked like it was probably put in like 1983 and was out of fashion then. And the haphazard art on the wall that's poorly hung and mismatched.
The TV room,
the old couch that doesn't match anything else. And it's just such a specific time and place. Mm. It truly takes me back almost as much as anything else in this film. They did such a great job of putting me there. And then the costumes, too. The outfits they put that poor girl in.
Terrible.
But it tells you so much about her when you see the way she dresses. It's like she's trying, but she doesn't have a clue.
Yeah, I said terrible. Great outfits for the character, but terrible outfits to have to wear if it was in reality or just for the character. But she certainly fits the part, the way they dress her.
When I hear the classical music they use, it made me think, well, this is public domain. They just can't afford a symphony. They can't afford to do what they probably would do. If they had a budget, maybe they would have an original score that would sound like that. I'm sure that a lot of films, before they have score, probably put classical music.
That's what happened in 2001.
Exactly. Then they just decided to keep it.
Kubrick liked it more than the score that Alex North wrote.
Yeah, and it's probably super affordable to just get a recording of classical music versus getting a composer and then recording all of that music.
Yeah. And the time it takes as well. And you play off of as well. It's the irony sometimes, especially in a comedy, of having this ethereal, sometimes outstandingly perfect music against a movie that's all about not being perfect.
Yeah, such a messy movie in a messy house with this messy character, and then some of the greatest music ever written and recorded.
What happens next? Well, Don goes on a kill-crazy rampage at Disney World. All those fellow students are not coming back, and either she maybe. Okay, what's more realistic is she just keeps taking it, bullies younger kids some more, and then eventually, as we find out in, you said, palindromes, kills herself.
So there's a version of the script palindromes. She fully comes back, and he wanted to cast Heather Matarazzo again, but she's a terrorist who suicide bombs something.
That fits with what I just said.
But he rewrote it because she read the script and was like, absolutely not, Dawn would never do this. They had a fight and a falling out, and they didn't speak again, and she didn't even find out that Dawn Wiener was coming back in Wiener Dog until she read about it in Variety or something. And she was pretty hurt about that because she's like, yeah, I totally would have revisited that part, but he didn't even offer it to me.
Okay. So our last thoughts on Welcome to the Dollhouse, or Middle Child, as we said, a better title. Middle Child in Middle School has a nice ring to it as well.
Well, I really think it holds up. It's still funny. It's cutthroat. It's a great representation also of the best of that trend of 90s indie edgy films. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the best kind of representations of that. You know, it's not edgy for the sake of edgy. It's edgy because it's gutsy. And I just have this one quote from Todd Solondz that I haven't managed to squeeze in yet that I think really sums up where he was coming from, a really relatable insight from him. He said, "When I was 11, I was at the peak of my creative powers. I was writing stories and plays, putting together poetry projects. I was absolutely absorbed in my, quote, work. But by the time I was 12, I was no longer reading or writing, just counting off days and checking them off. I was interested in survival." Because that is what puberty does to our creativity.
Yeah.
To our spirit.
Well, he has no trouble alienating his audience with a risky subject matter in this, Happiness, and I guess the other films too. But he also has a bizarre and often tremendous sense of humor.
It's really funny. I don't think we've talked about enough just how laugh-out-loud funny this movie is.
Well, definitely credit then to Alan Oxman and the actors themselves and Solondz for the timing.
Yes. And Heather Matarazzo is fabulous in this movie. Incredible. One of the better, if not best, child performances we've ever talked about.
Well, I still say Henry Thomas in E.T. or even...
I'm not saying she's the best, but I say she's up there.
She's on the list.
She makes this movie. Without her, it could not be. She's such a gutsy actor.
And she's the right casting because of the way she looks, because she's not Hollywood pretty. She's not Kirsten Dunst, I think it was probably the right age at that point. And as a great actress, probably could have pulled this off, but it also would have been a matter of, like the girl in the Carrie remake, Chloe Grace Moretz. You don't fit the role, especially compared to the way that it was played by Sissy Spacek in the mid-70s. Okay, in 7 days, we'll be posting our third episode in the month of Bev. This time we'll talk about Michael Moore's Oscar-winning documentary about how America just loves them some guns, Bowling for Columbine. I'm betting that's going to be a long episode and probably a lot of diversions way past the idea of the movie itself, talking about reality and what we've seen since that movie 20 years later. The coming attractions trivia question for Bowling for Columbine. During Michael Moore's Oscar acceptance speech, he mentions some people at the very end of the speech when they're drowning him out with the music, but you do hear it, where he says about George W. Bush, "Anytime you've got blank and blank against you, your time is up." Who were those people?
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Bowling for Columbine. In the meantime, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive. That'll get you a 20% discount.
End this podcast by saying, "Cut, you wiener dog." Or should I say, beaver. Bevers.
We're getting a divorce. And cut.
Bevers. I'm bringing it back.